You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer has spent nearly 30 years in military intelligence, and he's a recipient of the Bronze Star. The trouble began when he wrote a book called Operation Darkheart about his experience in the war zone in Afghanistan and his observations of the mismanagement of that war. It received a lot of media attention after the Pentagon purchased nearly all the copies of the first edition and destroyed them, citing national security concerns. It's since been released in a new edition with redactions made by the Department of Defense, and that version has just been published by St. Martin's Press, and it brings Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
What could you have written in the first version to cause the Pentagon to buy up every copy they could find? After all, we do get news reports from Afghanistan, don't we?
I think in some ways, officially, they say that they had concerns about the content relating to security. I'll say my answer to that is we spent 8 months working with Army going through, and I actually hired a researcher to go through and find open sources of all the data. And let me be very clear, there's stuff in that I did. 320 pages ain't a lot when it comes down to it. There's a lot of stuff that we did not put in relating to things which are still ongoing or more sensitive, and we were mystified when the DOD took such a harsh view of it.
Well, I'm assuming that the Department of the Army did certain redactions during its initial review.
As a matter of fact, yeah, there was things that I was required to take out because if I couldn't give a specific source, it was coming from me originally, then it had to come out.
So after you went to print, the Defense Intelligence Agency stepped in. And then they said there's still all sorts of stuff here that we can't allow?
That's what they said. Their letter was very inflammatory. It basically, to paraphrase, basically said that if this book is published, the free world will fall. I mean, that's kind of what they said. And you'll laugh at this, I know, because I've received this letter. And I'm still in the Army Reserve. So I get this letter that says all these, you know, it's terrible. And it's like, this is gold. I know instantly as a writer and a public affairs guy, this is – you can't get any better publicity. So I did the honest thing. I stopped and said, you don't want to give me this. I said to my leadership in the Army, this is – I'm telling you, this is going to have the exact opposite effect, and I asked them to not do it.
Can you talk freely now about what was in the original version, or is the Pentagon redacting your speech as well?
No, I because of my security agreement, there's two parts to my answer. First, I can't talk about everything. I can say that I still don't understand how the word Ned Beatty was redacted. I'll say that and it's like, okay,
He's a good actor. I could imagine redacting a bad actor.
Maybe the Taliban thought they were going to recruit him. I don't know. But there was, you know, I mean, that's like, okay. And then my second part of the answer is Mark Zaid, my attorney, is now considering legal action relating to the what we contend is largely almost all unclassified.
Well, people can find out what's going on because I've heard original copies of the book are available on eBay. They're selling for a lot, nearly $800, and the Pentagon really did help your sales by doing this.
Yes.
Scott Shane wrote an article in the New York Times in which he showed that some of the redactions made in your book are public knowledge, could be found on Wikipedia. And the first thing that a reader will notice when he or she looks at these redactions, because they've been blacked out, is that you can pretty much figure out what many of the words that have been eliminated are.
Well, I think that's one of the ironies of this. They started out with promising 18, and this is what the DOD lawyers and one defense human guy told the publisher, 18 surgical redactions, and we have some concerns about the names. Well, the names turned out were allowed. We can talk about that a bit because they're in the book. They made it into the second edition.
Other than Ned Beatty.
That's what I don't get. I mean, he's other than, you know, that's bizarre. But as it is, they made it in. And then the other thing is 18 turned into 256.
Well, I don't want to spend all the time on this. I actually want to spend some time on the book. But are there things that you know that I'm not getting from news reports?
Yeah. Well, I think there's two things in particular. I think the Pentagon wanted to at least postpone. I don't think they ever thought they could stop the book completely, but I think they wanted to postpone it. One of those things is timelines. The information I put in the book about the Taliban being resurrecting itself, being an insurgency.
We don't know that?
Well, we did, but we didn't know it started in 03. Again, ISI's duplicity, 03. The Iranians being involved funding insurgent activities, again, 03. So I think what happened here is we pushed the timeline back in a way that made him feel very uncomfortable relating to the current strategy.
Well, we've heard often about the ISI's duplicity.
Yes.
This is the Pakistani intelligence service. But you're saying 2003 is rather early?
Yes.
We assumed this was something that was happening later? I thought it was happening all along.
Well, it frankly had been happening all along, but we had strong evidence to the point of where we actually captured an ISI operative with the Taliban. And it's like you can't get much more, you know, direct linkage. And that was one of the things that I briefed the commanding general at the time, Lieutenant General Barno. And I'm arguing in the book, and I think factually your reader, the listeners will figure it out when they read it, that was a tipping point. It's where we kind of understood what we were doing up until that point. And then all of a sudden we took this left turn, which resulted in the chaos.
You've been in the military for 30 years, I said?
It'll be 30 years in January, yes.
And mostly in intelligence?
Most of that was, yes.
What's your military status now?
I'm in the Army Reserve. I'm currently serving in a division as the senior information officer, and that's all the Army wants me to talk about.
Well, you have gotten them upset in the past as well, haven't you? You testified before the 9/11 Commission about Operation Able Danger.
Yes.
That never even made it into the 9/11 Commission report.
Yeah, it's kind of peculiar because—
You were redacted there as well?
Well, essentially. What ended up happening on is I made my first of two protected disclosures to Dr. Philip Zelikow. He was the staff director of the 9/11 Commission while at Bagram. And it was that meeting which prompted him to say, what you said today is very important. And what I said was we identified Muhammad Atta and several other 9/11 hijackers as part of Able Danger. And it was so important to him that he actually wrote back that night according to his own account. And something happened between October and January because I show up in January in Washington and it's like, don't need to see you. Thank you anyway. And that was the end of that, I thought.
And Operation Able Danger was shut down.
It was, and we still have questions about why, because it had to do with pre-9/11 focus on al-Qaeda. All trails kind of end in January of 2001. No one can really talk about why an operation which was focused on being able to essentially take out al-Qaeda, take offensive operations against them, was shut down right before 9/11.
Do you think that it's just an embarrassment to the Bush administration?
I think
– are you suggesting that somebody knew something and that's why it was shut down?
I don't know. All I can do, and I've stuck to my facts, and I have a lot of friends who are 9/11 truthers. And the one thing that I think my friends who I don't agree with necessarily, but we do agree on one thing, that there are conspiracies, there are cover-ups. There was a book called The Commission, I believe, by Phil Sheenan that talked about the failures of certain elements of the commission to do certain things. I think there's enough grounds for a new investigation, and that's what I think most of us are interested in some aspects.
My guest is Anthony Schaefer, who's written a book called Operation Dark Heart, Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn imprint. So you were working on Able Danger.
Yes.
And then you went to Afghanistan. Now, you were freelancing at that time, weren't you? Did you go in and out of the military?
No. I was in a program which allowed you to be a civilian. I was a civilian employee of Defense Intelligence. And at the same
time, DIA,
Defense Intelligence Agency. And I was also a reservist. It was one of those things that you want to have dual status because if you're a government civilian – you want to be able to go into uniform to do military stuff. So that's why we have this program. So I did both.
There's a new show on television called Rubicon, which
yes.
is about how all the different intelligence agencies don't work together.
That's my experience.
Well, what is the DIA? How is
Defense Intelligence Agency is in many ways parallel to CIA. They were primarily created in 62. At the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, to be an intelligence analysis organization. They received a mission from DOD in 95, where they became the operational oversight and manager of all of the human intelligence programs in DOD that consolidated. So now they become essentially CIA for DOD.
And do the CIA and the DOD work together?
Not well.
Well, why wouldn't they?
Well,
I mean, didn't we learn a lesson on 9/11 that if all of the intelligence information we had gone through one agency or one person who knew what he or she was looking for, that we might have have prevented that from happening?
I believe that's to be the case. You're spot on. In addition to that, people still have fallen back into their old habits. Basically, information is of value. It's like money. That's the coin of the realm for the intelligence community. And many feel that it's my information. And it's like
we all protect our own bailiwicks.
That's right. And it's like the Abu Mutalib Christmas Day bombing. All the pieces were there, but they weren't shared. And Mr. Brennan, the terrorism advisor of the president, says, well, people didn't necessarily – they weren't prevented from sharing. Well, if they weren't prevented, that means they didn't – there was no incentive to share. Therefore, they didn't share.
You went to Afghanistan.
Yes.
How soon after the invasion?
Well, we were in 03, as a matter of fact. We were in the
so time – pretty soon.
Pretty quick. We were actually trying to start looking at how we could help the government of Afghanistan. That was one of the primary missions. And within the subtext of that was to eliminate threats and the going on to the anti-terrorism mission.
But you went under a cloud when you went there. You were already under investigation.
For three minor issues relating to a misuse of a cell phone to $67 and some odd cents, which was racked up, by the way, when I forwarded my government phone to my cell phone, my personal cell phone, over 18 months.
Do you think they were just going after you?
Oh, I think.
Because they saw you as a loose cannon?
I think a lot of people saw me that way. And that's probably an accurate statement.
What were your stated objectives when you got to Afghanistan?
To run operations. I was the operations officer overseeing all of Defense Intelligence Agency's activities on the ground in Afghanistan.
Human
intelligence. Yeah. More than that, we had things like polygraphers coming in and out. There was a polygraph program. We had a debriefing program, which worked with the FBI. It was a wide range of things we were doing. Plus, we had to work with the embassy, the attachés, and all that. So it was a lot more than what we have in the book.
And you say in the book, what you do have in the book, is that you were to provide command control to the Afghan army. Does that mean that you were in command of foreign troops?
No, not at all. I think the best you could say is we were trying to find ways to work more closely with them to help them establish their own system. In many ways, we were trying to even then to help them to establish independence from us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would imagine that an Afghan would find doing intelligence in his own country a lot easier than a foreigner.
One would think, yes. And that's one of the areas I can't get into how we worked on that. That's an area we completely stayed away from in the book. And that is an area we did work, yes.
You landed in Afghanistan at Bagram Air Base, which had previously been used by the Soviets during their occupation of the country. What was its condition?
Oh, it was let me tell you, there's nothing like going to a port-a-john at 6 a.m. when it's 22 degrees. It's an experience one never forgets.
So they didn't have indoor plumbing.
Oh, no. No, the only luxury we had, which was a luxury, which is we had showers, which were – we could get showers, one shower per day. We lived in GP medium tents, were nothing more than tents.
Now, Bagram is known now as a place where prisoners were held. Were they being held then?
Yes, absolutely.
Under the kinds of conditions that have shocked so many people?
Well, there's two separate prisons, and I talk about it a little bit in the book. Something called the Bagram Collection Point, which was the official prison, where, frankly, I was there quite often. The prisoners were treated with, I believe, within the Geneva Convention bounds. They were kept in small cages. Not small. I mean, we're talking about the size of this room, which is about probably 3 to 5 people per this room. Walked regularly. Everything apparently met the conditions required by the Geneva Convention.
There this were is other the normal prisons. Size of a prison cell, I would think.
I would think so, yes.
I see it as my prison cell.
But you have a very, very positive attitude anyway. But the thing is, there were other – I was given a tour of the other prison. And that's connected in my book, and I talk about the fact that I was kind of offered access, and I said, no, thanks. Thanks for showing me this.
But as somebody who was in intelligence, you must have had all sorts of ideas as to how to collect it.
Yeah.
And what we've heard since is that there was torture and all sorts of other things that many people in the intelligence field think are counterproductive.
I think they're hugely counterproductive. I actually do a two-chapter treatment of us going and interrogating someone who was wrapped up as part of a raid on a compound. I can't go into a lot of detail because that was a heavily redacted two chapters, but you still figure out what's going on. And I'm proud to say the FBI and I were able to essentially break the guy, and I mean break metaphorically, not physically, within a certain amount of time that we had to do it.
The FBI has a very different idea of how to do interrogations than the CIA, obviously.
And obviously.
That's been part of the problem.
Well,
you're closer to the FBI in its approach.
I'm a great admirer of the FBI, and I've worked with them a number of operations all over the world. So,
my guest is Anthony Schaefer, who's written a book called Operation Darkheart. I'm sure that if you've read Joseph Conrad, you see a connection. The subtitle is Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. It's published in the Thomas Dunn imprint of St. Martin's Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Anthony Schaefer, S-C-H-A-F-F-E-R. His book, Operation Darkheart, Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory, which is published by St. Thomas Press and the Thomas Dunn imprint. So you were working with Afghan soldiers. What was your impression of them when you arrived?
Well, it was, I remember seeing them walking by the side of the road, and it was a challenging time by the fact that we had won not by using Afghan soldiers. We won by using Afghan militia forces, AMF. The warlords and other tribal leaders helped us win. And that was the key to victory then. And I've argued in my path to victory, we need to start looking at the Shura, which are the tribal elders, and those which have been there for 10,000 years. Right now, the idea of having this federal force come in and sustain itself is a bit of a bridge too far almost, I believe.
On the other hand, people have argued that by depending on the warlords, we allowed all sorts of things to happen.
We did.
When Osama bin Laden was trapped, the warlord who was supposedly helping us was bought off by the Taliban,
right.
And Osama escaped.
I agree, and that's a problem with that era. I think that Gary Bernstein's book, I've read at Jawbreaker, he made the right assessment. We can't trust them. There's certain times you have to trust them, certain times you can't trust them, and I think that's where there's mixed loyalty. We've got to be a lot more understanding of their culture and their perception. I argue they understand us a lot better than we understand them.
What were the recruitment strategies for the Afghan army?
Well, at the time when we brought people in, the idea was mutual interests. One of the things that happened is that you have tribal differences. And I actually talk about an incident where bad intelligence from one tribe was used to leverage our resources to kill an enemy. And this is where I think we were able to gain some benefit by the fact if you understand a tribe's motivation, it goes back to the old adage of consider the source. There are issues which they're interested in helping you on. There are other things that they don't like helping you on, and you got to identify which is which. So when you engage in this sort of thing, it's very important, critically important to understand their culture, how they see the world. And for example, one of the things that we missed, I think, and we had it as an advantage to begin with, is the idea that we were there to extract vengeance. Their culture is eminently for the idea of vengeance. If you wrong me, I have every right to come do whatever to you.
So they would have understood that we were going, that we went there because Afghanistan was where the
exactly.
Taliban and Al-Qaeda were based.
Right. And that's where we should have kind of kept it. Unfortunately, the problem is we started taking on what they call an image of an occupier, the Soviet standard of occupying terrain. And the moment you start building large permanent buildings, people start scratching their heads like, you're really going to leave? I mean, what's going on here? So that's where the PR got really bad for us.
Well, there are warlords and there are warlords, aren't there?
Yes.
Could we have identified the ones who would have worked best with us?
We did. And then we walked away from them then too because we started supporting the Karzai government as the primary focus rather than working with all the warlords.
When in all of this did the invasion of Iraq occur?
In 2003. As a matter of fact,
not long after you arrived,
it was. I was one of the planners on for the intelligence piece of the Iraq invasion. That was my last. I'd come out of command of an operating base. I then worked as a planner, and then I deployed to Afghanistan.
Did you see the kind of debacle it's become?
Let me put it this way: when we were in one of the planning meetings, a colonel comes in, who's in my book, by the way, Colonel Sadler, comes in and says,
played by Ned Beatty.
Apparently so. Comes in and says, we are going to be opening an embassy within 30 days of the invasion. And we all like look around. It's like, that's not possible. He says, no, you don't understand. The children will be throwing flowers at our feet and whole divisions will peel off and defect. And I have the same feeling now as I had at that moment. this chill up my spine saying there's something wrong here.
But this is the sort of thing we were hearing from Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld.
Absolutely.
You later bumped into Donald Rumsfeld after a workout.
I did. I was doing pull-ups on a bar outside of the Pentagon, and it was right next to the POAC, which is the facility there. And this is a cute little story. I actually come off my
pull-up bar. That's why I brought it up.
I can't believe you know this. I popped off the pull-up bars. This is like early October, right after 9/11. And there's a small man, small stature man in a pink shirt walking by, and he's trying to get into this entrance, which has been permanently closed off. And so being polite, I said, "Excuse me, sir, you can't get in that way." And it turns around, it's Don Rumsfeld. And he says, "Why is this door closed?" It's like, "Sir, if you don't know, we're in trouble." I thought that. I didn't say it. But the idea was, you know, that I ran into him right after 9/11 there at the Pentagon.
He had no sense that there was tight security?
Well, I thought it was kind of peculiar that, you know, we were tightening up and they shut that door down. And it was ironic, I think.
Well, how did the war in Iraq affect operations in Afghanistan? I'm assuming that that personnel and equipment were allocated to Iraq, and suddenly you found yourself with little to work with.
Well, as a matter of fact, having little to work with was the right idea. I think there's two things that come from being lean. You have to be very efficient, and you can be very effective by the fact you don't have a lot of bureaucracy to go through. So we used it to our advantage. I think we were very, very effective in keeping up with the Taliban's efforts. And there's a whole chapter dedicated to a battle called Mountain Viper, where we're actually able to break the back of the first offensive of the Taliban coming back into Afghanistan.
So the shift of the focus allowed you to work more freely.
Oh, absolutely. With what we have now is layered bureaucracy. What we had then was I could go to one guy and then be talking to the commanding general right away.
At one point, didn't the CIA station chief in Kabul, Jacob Walkers, offer you a job?
He alluded to that fact because I talked about the fact that I just come from working in a joint facility with him. And it's been well known that they've been scarfing up DOD officers to fill their ranks. We were trained at the same facility.
They were poaching on other intelligence organizations?
Poaching is exactly what you have the exact term correct, yes.
Why would they? I would have thought the CIA would have more than a few qualified people.
Oh, they do. But there's two things that military officers can bring to the table. First off is military experience. A lot of the officers that come into CIA are very young. I mean, they come right out of college and they don't have a lot of life experience. And the second thing is the fact that when you get into a situation like Afghanistan, you want people who can actually move around freely and understand what's going on. And I think we had a better understanding of things than they did in many ways.
My guest is Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who's written a book called Operation Dark Heart. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn imprint. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How did the armed forces fail to understand the enemy's change in tactics at this point?
Well, you know, it's, I think, a policy of wishful thinking. In many ways, a lot of folks were depending on Pakistan carrying its own weight. I think we identified clearly, and I talk about in the book, the existence of safe havens, Taliban safe havens in Pakistan. And let me be very clear for your listeners. I'm not saying Operation Dark Heart would have won the war. The whole idea was to buy us more time to let us figure out what to do on the Afghan side. And that was what the problem was. They pushed it to the Pakistanis saying, you've got to take care of this. And this goes back to our misunderstanding of the culture. We should have gone in there and taken care of it because we had the right as the venged party. The Pakistanis get in there and they just become part of the problem.
Well, there have long been questions about what the Pakistanis really want in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Obviously, they see it as a place where they'd like to have a sphere of influence.
Yes.
They're also competing with India for that.
Absolutely.
The ISI had supported the Taliban.
Yes, helped create
Benazir Bhutto and
right.
had been giving them money and support. So, and even now I understand there are people in the Pakistani government who would like to see al-Qaeda and the Taliban out and others who are still giving them money.
And that's part of the problem, this duplicity of effort. The Haqqani network in particular, and people need to understand that the Taliban is really a tapestry. It's not a monolithic organization. The Haqqani network, which has been one of the most effective sub-organizations, has actually been used as a proxy of the Pakistani military. And I think that's part of the problem is that you have we have allowed this to happen where the Haqqani network has actually hit Indian targets in Kabul. I mean, the power plant the Indians built, sore spot. And it's just overall, it's a Cold War, just much like between us and the Soviets, We've now have that going on in the microcosm in that area of the world.
Just the other day on NPR, there was a report about the Afghan army, and they were being trained. And by the time I think they came back from maneuvers, one-third had deserted.
Yeah.
And some of them had gone back to their homes, but others had joined the Taliban. And one of the reasons was the Taliban actually pays its soldiers. The Taliban has more money than the Afghan government to pay its soldiers.
And
aren't we shipping in money to pay for these Afghan soldiers?
That money does not always make it down to the level it's supposed to. And that's been documented as well, that money goes in and not necessarily gets to where it be. And that, speaking of that, there's a great story by a reporter friend of mine. I can't say his name, but he was embedded with the Taliban for a while. He talked about talking to these Taliban guys who are going and attacking government facilities, and their brother may be in the Afghan army. And so he'll call his brother and saying, hey, I'm going to be attacking your facility tomorrow. Don't shoot over to the left because that's where I'm going to be. And so it's almost a joke in some ways about the relationship thing.
So this is not really about commitment in many cases. It's simply which army is willing to pay you?
It's about tribalism, which goes back to the 10th century, and we've, I think, have failed to understand it and unfortunately taken sides with one of the tribes, in this case the Karzai tribe.
You say the lack of a bureaucracy and institutional oversight work in the enemy's favor.
The lack of? No, I think the lack of, in our case, of having a smaller footprint was good. Now the larger bureaucracy, I think, is has the same problem. We have a large bureaucracy which does not, And its performance of accountability hides accountability because you have so many layers and no one's in charge. And I think that's what we've seen time and time again, where we go through and have people not held to account for failure to act on good intelligence. Bad policies, I believe, have killed more people than bad intelligence as we've gone through this.
Now, this book is filled with things that are called Operation This, Operation That.
Yes.
Operation Mountain Viper.
Yes. That was an operation actually conducted by the 10th Mountain. We like naming things, you know. It's good to have as a, you know, I think it gives people a sense of what you're doing for that period of time. Mountain Viper was actually the 10th Mountain Division's work to break the back of the Taliban's first offensive. The Taliban learned very quickly in 03 that you can't take on the U.S. Army force on force, not easily, and they lost badly. So this is where they recognized they'd had to go to the insurgency methodology versus taking us on force.
Well, they'd already learned that fighting against the Soviets, hadn't they?
Well, apparently they thought maybe because we were very small in number. Keep in mind, when I was there in 03, we had 10,500 troops total. That's the entire country, and that country is larger than Iraq. So we were very minimally staffed there.
So did the recent surge, was that a mistake because that kind of thing doesn't work all that well against an insurgency, against guerrilla fighters?
Let me answer that in two parts. First, it was a mistake because we're not doing a counterinsurgency. A counterinsurgency to be done by the book would require 500,000 to 600,000 troops and going into all the major urban areas. We didn't do that. So what we did is we did it light. And right now we're focused on five provinces, and they know that. So if you're not going to do it properly, then you got to do something differently. And I think the 10,000, the 100,000 there right now is nothing but getting in the way of allowing the tribes to work things out. If I were the president, I would declare victory tomorrow and start the drawdown now. I would throw them off the timeline that we've told because we've laid out to them what we're doing all along.
Well, there are reports just today that the Karzai government is entering into peace negotiations with the Taliban.
Right.
The Taliban really did terrible things when they controlled most of Afghanistan.
They
are
did.
Are people fearful that might return?
I think yes and no. In some ways, it will return by the fact if we leave, it's going to happen because they've threatened that. I do believe that by creating circumstance where we have regional allies to keep them in balance, I think they would be more. And I'm not saying we should leave. I think we should leave about 20,000 troops there to take care of business. The idea of walking away is the wrong idea.
Can we win in Afghanistan?
Well,
nobody ever has, it seems. We're talking about 2,000 to 3,000 years of people trying to conquer this area, and nobody's ever succeeded.
The path to victory is in Pakistan. Basically, we got to focus on stabilizing Pakistan. I think everything else will fall out of that. Don't forget the PACs have the nukes. That needs to be what we're worried about because both Taliban and Al-Qaeda have said they want to get a hold of those nuclear weapons.
You called your book Operation Darkheart. That was an operation?
That was.
Named after Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness?
I actually got the idea after learning some intelligence about the safe havens and what to do about it. I actually was watching Apocalypse Now, and the scene of Marlon Brando as Colonel Kurtz talking about the horror. Well, the idea of behind Darkheart was very simple and brutal. I'm not going to lie about it. The idea was to make life miserable for those folks in the safe havens so that they could not focus on planning operations in Afghanistan.
And disrupting the senior members of the Taliban.
Disrupting and making it very difficult for them to do their job, yes.
Did it work?
Well, we started down that path, and unfortunately we were shut down before we could fully implement the operation.
Why were you shut down, do you think?
Well, that's in the book. It had to do with a general officer and his policy, and it was a change of leadership and a change of policy. One general officer said yes, and another said no.
Can you tell us about the Taliban hotel?
Well, it was a command and control node where we recognized there were leadership hanging out there and planning operations. There's certain things you can learn just by watching, and we recognized that that was a major command and control node for what was going on within the region.
In every war, there are mistakes, and yes. It seems like there have been a lot here, drone attacks that have hit the wrong people, and yes. Now we learn about these soldiers who were shooting Afghan civilians just for the sheer sport of it. How does that play in Afghanistan?
Well, badly. I mean, as you can imagine, that's just wrong. And, you know, I'd stopped convoys because we would take water and toss it out to the kids. And one time I witnessed one of our soldiers throwing it at a kid. I stopped the convoy and, you know, and said, if you do that again, I will take care of that business with you. It's always wrong. And it we've got to be better. We've got to take the high ground and set the good example. And it's just no matter who you are in the Army or in the service, that's not tolerable.
A listener, Peter, left a question on our show page. What do you think about WikiLeaks? Does it endanger our sources and our forces in Afghanistan, as the DOD claims?
I think that if you publish names of assets and specific locations, you have the potential to do that. And so the answer is yes, I think it can happen. I looked through the WikiLeaks documents. I don't know what could be used. However, let me be very clear about the WikiLeaks issue. I'm not for WikiLeaks. Despite the hell I've gone through to get my book cleared, I've always tried to do everything I do tied to an oversight organization, either Congress or some other organization, with the idea of creating circumstance for change and improvement. WikiLeaks right now is kind of just poking people in the eye with no real objective, and that's where I have a problem with it, is they're giving kind of a black eye to whistleblowers in many ways.
You say you're in the reserve. That means you're still in the Army.
That's correct.
Does writing a book like this and going through all of this make life miserable?
Well, it hasn't made it any easier. I felt it was a compelling story that people needed to hear about, especially relating to the tipping point. I think a lot of Americans have never really understood what went wrong there. Clearly it went wrong, but like, how did it start? So I felt very compelled to get that out.
And what led you to leave Afghanistan? Had you just done your tour of duty?
Well, I was actually in the middle of a second tour when the disclosure of the 9/11 Able Danger information caught up with me. I was demanded to come back, and like the end of a good episode of 24, my badges were taken, and I was escorted out of the building. So,
you just got to learn how to button up your lip.
I haven't got that memo yet.
Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, his book, Operation Darkheart, Spycraft and Special Ops on the Frontline of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn imprint. And it's fun reading the redactions and trying to figure out what the words are.
People still figure it out. I've gotten good feedback so far. So.
And maybe I can spring for the $800 on eBay. How many books slip through, do you think?
Oh, I've been told between 50 to 100. I don't know if they really have a good hard count on it. But unfortunately, they're out there.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.